90.3 FM in Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do
you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
I'm speaking with Abigail and Stefan. Abigail and Stefan are both members of the Syndicat des Locataires Autonomes de Montréal, the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. They're known as SLAM by their French acronym. And they're going to give us an overview of some of the organizing they've done over the past year or two and dealing with this stunning housing crisis that's happening in Montreal. Abigail and Stefan, welcome to No Borders Media and Off the Hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Let's maybe start with getting a sense of what SLAM, the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, does and how you're involved. So, Abigail, let us know more about SLAM, where it comes from and what its goals are and your role in it.
Sure, yeah. So I guess I've been organizing my building with SLAM for about a year now. Like, Stefan and one other tenant came and knocked on my door last February. And so that's how I got involved with the union. And we really emphasize direct action as opposed to like taking the tribunal as a means of dealing with landlords. So like one thing we did at my building was we organized a petition, for example, where we listed all of our demands with like, we needed adequate hot water, we needed working washers and dryers, we needed Wi-Fi, we had a pest problem that wasn't taken care of, a bunch of things like that. And so SLAM kind of helped us out with finding tactics to pressure our landlord into getting those things. That's it. It's mostly about direct action.
That's great. And Abigail, you got the knock, and it was Stefan who was doing the knocking along with another comrade. So Stefan, tell us from your perspective what SLAM's all about and what it can offer to tenants here in Montreal.
Yes, so SLAM stands for the Syndicat des Locataires Autonomes de Montréal, or in English, the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. It is, like Abby's saying, it uses direct action, which can be anything from sending an email blast to landlord all at the same time on a Tuesday morning, or all the way up to a rent strike, and everything in between, like dropping banners from your balcony, or doing a march on your landlord's head office, or to their house. It also considers itself non-hierarchical. So that means there's nobody elected, nobody in the union's paid, everyone's there sort of on a volunteer basis. And we meet every 2 weeks to make decisions about everything that goes on in the union. Of course, there's subcommittees. So I'm on the organizing committee. So I help with things like door knocking and outreach to tenants who might be interested in forming a union within their building. For us, unionizing as a tenant can mean one of two things, either joining our bigger union. So this can be done if somebody lives in a duplex, if somebody does not want to take that step of organizing with their neighbors immediately. And this provides support and solidarity that you otherwise would not get just by being in a struggle with your landlord alone, because you have people from outside the building who are from the larger union who are there to support you. Or unionizing can also mean forming a tenant council in your building or in your block, like Abby did, and they can talk about that if they want. And that's sort of regularly getting together with neighbors once every 2 weeks. It also includes planning actions in order to put pressure on the landlord, or planning events in order to build community within your building or block. So that kind of forms the core of SLAM activities. Essentially gathering tenants, organizing them into tenant councils, or providing them with resources so that they can join the union, and putting pressure directly on landlords. We also also take the position that tenants while we are fighting for tenants, we also believe in fighting for the interests of people who are currently homeless, because they are also affected by the housing crisis and are the people worst affected by the housing crisis. They are people who would be tenants if the rents were low enough and the conditions were good enough for them, but they're not tenants because of the absence of those two things. And so they have been forced into the very cruel reality of living in streets or in shelters. And so we have a specific committee called the Unhoused Solidarity Committee, which has been organizing actions around homeless encampments, and also in the past actions to just generally provide mutual aid to people who are unhoused.
I'm a bit of an organizing nerd. I like to know the nitty gritty of things. Having been someone who's organized here for the last 20 years or so. So I'm curious about what was the initial impetus to get SLAM going, Stefan, and maybe Abigail can chime in after you respond. And also, how many of these tenants councils are there? How many people are we talking about? I can imagine that unpaid organizing that goes door to door, that's dealing with such a visceral reality, so where somebody lives, is on one hand, you know, an essential form of organizing, but on the other hand, not easy over the long term. So could you talk a bit about where you started, how you sustain yourselves, how many councils you got going, how many people are involved, roughly speaking? You know, we don't need to know too many details. And feel free to chime in after Abby, after Stefan, give some of those details.
So the union was really inspired by the example set by Parkdale Organize. Parkdale Organize is a Toronto militant neighborhood organization, which has existed for almost a decade now. They organized a massive rent strike in the Parkdale neighborhood in Toronto in 2017 that had 300 tenants, and they went on rent strike. Well, it reached up to 300 tenants, and the rent strike lasted 7 months. They ended up stopping a massive rent hike in their buildings, and also from the details of the deal they had with the company were so good that they got a non-disclosure agreement. The company forced a non-disclosure agreement. But from what I understand, tenants also got some tenants got a rent decrease from the mobilizations they were doing. And then the next year in Toronto, other tenants in different buildings, I think it was about 55 tenants, also went on rent strike in 2018 and also managed to beat back some of a massive rent increase that they were facing. So we thought this was a really interesting example. There's a great documentary that some of us have seen called This is Parkdale, which shows the kind of neighborhood organizing that went into it, and the ability to just draw in working class people who are not political activists and who do not come from the classic university educated culture, which tends to draw in most of the militant sphere. And activate them in ways that are very radical, taking actions like rent strikes and being able to build historic moments of struggle. So for us, the appeal of a tenants union was that it's a kind of organizing in which we're relating to people's direct interests. We're giving them something tangible that they could work towards, like building conditions that directly affect them, or rent increases that directly affect them, and illustrating tactics which, at least in my case, like as an anarchist, I very much believe should be spread, tactics of direct action rather than I guess what you could call like going to courts to solve issues or appealing to the governments to enact legislation to solve our issues for us. And it also provides and I'll sort of finish here because this is, I'm also a bit of an organizing nerd, so I feel like I could also talk about this for a bit, but like I do feel as though it does provide the basis for a truly mass movement, just as the labor movement did, because again of the fact that this is not some sort of altruistic campaign that we're encouraging people to do. Like, we're not encouraging people to fight exactly for other people, even though that's a very good thing, and Solidarity should be something that is something that we encourage. But we're encouraging people to fight for their own interests in very direct ways. And so we think that that strategy allows us to activate a very broad number of people. And we think that the creation of this mass movement can seriously create circumstances in which things like massive rent strikes are possible. And these massive rent strikes can lead to moments in which tenants are able to leverage their power to get serious gains, be it widespread rent decreases, or even hopefully one day the expropriation of our homes and the creation of like a massive network of housing cooperatives.
Abigail, give our listeners a sense of what organizing looks like from your point of view within SLAM. You mentioned earlier that you're part of, you got involved as part of your own building. I guess you're part of a tenants council. So what does that day-to-day organizing look like? What's it like to be mobilizing or supporting or mobilizing with your neighbors to fight for, you know, hot water and getting rid of pests and all these other basic things that tenants have to deal with negligent or greedy landlords?
Right. I think it's mostly, for me, I think of it also as like kind of building a social network, like as a good in and of itself, even if it takes forever to get wins from your landlord. It's kind of funny because I thought that like burnout might be a bigger issue because housing is so, like you said, it's such a visceral personal issue and it like can be tough to deal with your shitty landlord, worry about like rising rents, and then also like go to a SLAM meeting and discuss those things further. But I actually find it like more invigorating because also it has given us the opportunity to establish kind of a community. Like there are definitely, there are a lot of international students and immigrants in my building where like I'm one of the only people that they know like in Canada. So I think that like, even just knocking on your neighbor's door, Stefan always advises people to bring a plate of fresh baked cookies, which also works. So like, if you want to get to know your neighbors, do some baking, bring them some cookies, talk to them about like what their living situation is like, what their relationship with the landlord is like. Because I think that like the way that we have housing, our current housing model is like super atomizing and individualistic because most of the time people, when they encounter issues, they're engaging in this individual struggle with their landlord. When if you get to talking to people in your buildings, they probably have the exact same issues. Like before I started my tenants council last year, I truly did not know that other people were having problems with mice. I didn't know that some of my neighbors just didn't have hot water. So I think it's also really just about trying to establish personal relationships with people in your building. Like it's just nice to know your neighbors. So yeah, a lot of organizing I would say is about just getting to know your neighbors in a friendly way.
I've always said in a lot of different organizing contexts that, you know, the first step to organizing is breaking isolation and breaking fear. And it seems like that's exactly what you just described, Abigail, that, you know, the step of breaking isolation is just having a conversation facilitated by baked cookies maybe, and then seeing the power that can come with the collective action, whether that's two people, whether that's 10 people, whether that's 100 or 200 people. So it's one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to both of you, because it's very inspiring that that basic model of door-to-door organizing and breaking isolation and breaking fear is so basic, but and it's so inspiring, but you know, it needs to be sort of flushed out. And in that spirit, let's talk about some of the actions you folks have done over the last little while. I'll lay out a few of them, and then Abigail, you can choose one of them to talk about in a bit more detail, something that maybe you found inspiring, and maybe Stefan could talk about another one. I know that you've been providing support in the spirit of what Stefan mentioned earlier of seeing homelessness and people who are dealing with being involved, street-involved folks as, you know, part of a larger housing struggle. So you've been providing support to an outdoor encampment, and there's these encampments all over North America, really, but all over Canada over the last couple of years. So you've been supporting one under the Ville-Marie Expressway in downtown West Montreal. You've been part of supporting a petition to keep to take down a fence that was put up on Park Avenue, where there's a lot of street involved folks. And obviously, you've gone after landlords like Cromwell and Cogir. So, Abigail, can you maybe talk about one of those actions, give our listeners a sense of what direct action on housing looks like?
Yeah, for sure. I think of the campaigns you mentioned, the ones I've been most involved in have probably been Cogir, Cromwell, and my building. Like, I can talk about what I've done here, because the first thing we did was kind of the most basic tactic that Stefan mentioned, which was doing an email blitz. So we all like composed emails. We sat on this Zoom call, wrote down all of the problems we had had individually with our apartments, and then we all sent that to my landlord like at the same time. And it immediately got a reaction with him. Which, like, keep in mind, most of us had been pestering him to do really basic maintenance things for months, and he had just ghosted us. So even just getting any form of acknowledgement already felt like a huge win. He started messaging people on Facebook asking who was responsible for it. I think it really intimidated him. And then, like, we followed up with a petition, I think maybe 1 or 2 weeks later, which we got almost everyone in the building to sign. What I've found is that like almost everybody is always willing to sign a petition. Like you might not get everyone in your building super involved in like the really nitty gritty organizing stuff, but you can definitely get people to send an email or sign a petition. And those things are surprisingly effective, I think, because landlords just don't expect the tenants to work together. So when they see that's happening, they get a little scared. And then within like a week, we had all of our hot water tanks replaced and the Wi-Fi was improved. So that definitely worked. It did end up getting a little nastier later on. We were doing more door knocking one day and I met a new tenant and gave him my email address. And I think that he told the landlord that someone had come by to talk to him about the problems in the building. And he gave the landlord my name. And so the next day I got a knock on my door and it was Satish and his father. And he chewed me out. He told me I shouldn't be talking to other tenants, that it wasn't any of my business. His dad told me I should be like trying to make straight A's in school instead of worrying about my neighbors. And so at that point, I mean, if I had been working just individually, I may have just backed down. I'm not really sure what I would do, but because I had SLAM and because we had this like whole network of everyone in the building involved, it wasn't actually that scary. It was mostly just a little amusing to me. So, I mean, I think that like, even if you don't get into the more militant tactics of like, going to your landlord's house or like marching into their office, it can still be very effective just because the like sheer fact that people are talking to each other about their problems is enough to stress out your landlord. And I think it's similar with like the Cromwell building. You know, the landlord was trying to rent evict basically everybody, literally like 100 something, over 100 tenants, I think, got rent evicted because there are like around 120 units in that building. Only 12 of them are currently occupied, if I'm not mistaken. And so when people started getting together and organizing a petition, we also did a banner drop in November. The Cromwell management at least agreed to like sit down and talk to the tenants, which in and of itself was a huge win because they had just been ignored up until that point.
Amazing. Thanks for sharing that, Abigail. Stefan, do you want to share one or two of the actions that you folks have undertaken, specifically maybe something that targets a major corporate landlord?
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of funny when you were doing the rundown, there were some things which I hadn't even remembered, such as the fight against the fence in Milton Park. That was so long ago. But
Just to interrupt you for a second, I found that really inspiring because, as you know, as Abigail likely knows, people were displaced from homeless folks, folks that access medical services. Disproportionately, I think it's fair to say people from northern indigenous communities, live in that area, and they've been extremely demonized. And that's where Raphael Napa died during the pandemic. When he had to leave a shelter and he died in an extremely cold day. So yeah, that kind of solidarity is so crucial and so important, especially with folks that that are completely forgotten or demonized by society, including often by the left. So I just wanted to highlight that, and I'm glad that reminder has been made, although that issue continues because the situation in that area isn't great in terms of how folks are able to access services and the rest.
Oh yeah, I absolutely agree. I agree. And there was even a portion of the left. Well, there was actually a large portion of the left in the Milton Park neighborhood, which does have a leftist presence, particularly among the older generation, as in like anybody older than 30, who just refused to be activated by the issue about the fence. Everyone in the neighborhood knew what was happening in terms of this fence pushing people onto the sidewalk and onto the street. Like you said, one person died in the neighborhood in the winter during the lockdown. But there was also one woman who died shortly after this fence was put up. Basically, this area is sort of like it was an unfenced area away from the sidewalk in which people would congregate and hang out. People would even put tents there and sleep there. It's an unused lot owned by a company based in Toronto. It's not currently serving any function. It's not even parking space or anything. And the company decided, because they did not have the sort of legal liabilities of having people who were homeless in the space all the time, they decided to put a massive fence up and enclose the space. And so people lost where they traditionally would congregate. After the fence was put up, an Indigenous woman, basically running away from an abusive partner, was not able to run into this space, which usually would have given them room to sort of like move around away from the street, and was forced to run into the street and was hit by a car and died. And a lot of the people who were there and witnessed it, immediately made the connection between the fence's role in pushing people out of the way of the sidewalk, and the role of its role in her death. Anyways, so in terms of broader tenant mobilization, to this day we've probably organized about a dozen or so tenant councils in different buildings. With varying successes. Our biggest success so far is probably within buildings owned by Cogir. So Cogir is it is a massive company. It is one of the biggest landlords in terms of net worth in all of Montreal. They operate in the Milton Park neighborhood where we were organizing within their buildings. They operate about five buildings. With a total of probably about 300-400 tenants, we were active in three of those buildings, and the organizing started with a block meeting that we did on one strip of street. Basically, we had heard about an eviction that was happening on the strip of street, and we had no idea which building it had been in. Somebody had just said, like, I saw someone being evicted. They didn't seem happy about it. It was between, what was it? I think it was like between Prince Arthur and Pine. And so we went to the block of street and we just called a meeting. We handed out flyers, calling every tenant who lived on the block, to a meeting to discuss their rental conditions. And these were tenants of different landlords. We got to the day of the meeting and the only people who showed up were the Cogir tenants, from two different buildings, on the street. And they were really pumped to like organize around the issues that they were facing in their buildings, which included things like the presence of mold, the lack of repairs, the company stealing money from them. People's mailboxes were broken, people's heaters were broken, heating was being turned on late. There were instances of flooding, as well as just fire alarms going off at all times of night. And so we started organizing. We got some petitions together. The organizing was pretty slow at first. It took about 2 months to get a petition off the ground. And during that time, we had another Cogir tenant from a building just a block away who also approached the union separately. We used that opportunity to start organizing in his building as well. So after 2 or 3 months, we had over 100 signatures from different Cogir tenants that onto petitions asking for changes in Cogir buildings as well as decreased rent. We handed the petitions to the company and we didn't get any response, except for a very passive aggressive email from one of the members of lower management in the company to one of the building petitions. We also organized like all Cogir potlucks where we invited Cogir tenants from all over Montreal to like share a meal together. But the biggest action we undertook was marching on Cogir's head offices. So we used a strategy which comes from labor organizing called March on the Boss, in which you get people who are directly affected by an issue to march on the headquarters of, well, in the instance of labor organizing, the boss, and in the instance of tenant organizing, the landlord, and confront them about the issues that they're facing directly. Usually, like you nominate people for different roles, such as like some one person is going to give testimony about their experience, another person's going to lead chants, another person's going to video the whole thing, and one person's going to sort of make sure the landlord doesn't run out of the room or like change the subject, basically keeping them on track. So we gathered about 20 people together and we marched on the head offices of Cogir. And it was extremely effective. We ended up stopping work for about 40 minutes. And the next morning, the vice president of Cogir, which again is a massive company, so it was quite something to see an email just directly from the vice president of this company show up in our inboxes after they'd been ignoring us for so long. And the vice president wanted to meet. And so we met. And over a series of meetings over about 3 or 4 months, we sort of brought up all of the issues that every tenant was facing. At these meetings, we invited all the tenants from the different Cogir buildings. I think the first meeting had about like 12, 15 tenants who showed up. And people confronted management about the issues that they had in their buildings. And pretty much everyone's issue that they brought up was solved, including tenants who owed rent being forgiven thousands of dollars of that rent. One tenant who didn't want to live in his unit anymore got the landlord to agree to cancel his lease, which is a very rare thing. And other tenants who had repairs worth hundreds of dollars got those done as well as tenants who had, especially like tenants who had broken mailboxes. They got a check of $210, I believe, in the mail directly from the company. So it was a series of massive wins, just through the use of direct action without having to go to any court system to get those. Otherwise, Abby was saying the Cromwell buildings, and there's a few other campaigns that we have underway currently that are just being kept a little low key until something comes of them or until tenants want to sort of go public with.
Abigail and Stefan from the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, SLAM in French. One of your most recent actions this past Monday was in support of the Ville Marie encampment, where folks have been living underneath an overpass in downtown West. So, can you talk a bit about that support work, what happened on Monday, and the link between that and an autonomous tenants union? Let's maybe start with Stefan.
Yeah, so this is an encampment under the Ville Marie Expressway. Sorry, I just have this clock that's just going off right now. But so this is an encampment under the Ville-Marie Expressway. It is maybe the biggest encampment in Montreal currently of people who are unhoused. It had about 30 residents when we first started organizing in it. It is a place where many people go over the past like 5 or 10 years. Some of the residents have been living there that long. We first started organizing in it back in November when Resilience Montreal, which is an organization that runs a homeless shelter near Atwater, put out a call for a solidarity action against an impending eviction of the encampment. So we pretty quickly organized a protest because we realized we were probably the best organization to do so. All of the nonprofits who worked in the area didn't seem to want to touch the organizing of a militant anti-eviction demonstration. So yeah, initially none of the nonprofits wanted to touch the organizing of a militant demonstration. And there was no really like militant group other than SLAM who was really felt close to the issue. So we put together an action, we put together a call out, and that got a lot of people saw that, and a lot of people had a really encouraging response to it. The post definitely blew up, and we had a demonstration planned for, I believe it was a Thursday morning at 10 a.m. And the day before the protest was planned, Transport Quebec decided to call off the eviction. So it seems as though the protest helped to generate a lot of pressure on the transport ministry, and the eviction was called off. Before that, we had already been starting to make some relationships with people in the encampment, especially when we were planning the anti-eviction protest to make sure, like, to see what they were comfortable with in terms of actions that could be undertaken in such a demo. But after the eviction was postponed, we started doing barbecues with members of the encampment. We started visiting regularly, seeing if they needed help with anything, especially one of the encampment members who maybe has maybe is like the most outgoing, definitely. He started coming over to SLAM headquarters. He helps cook for events that we're doing that are unrelated to the encampment. He's also a union member now, and we took the opportunity of the past few months to deepen our relationships with people living the encampment. Unfortunately, its size has shrunk due to a number of factors, but it will probably increase again, as it usually does, once the winter is over and people are able to sleep outside again. However, we got news probably a few weeks ago that there was going to be another eviction of the encampment scheduled for around the first week of March. So we pretty quickly threw together an anti-eviction demonstration as well as an anti-eviction action. We started by doing sort of the march on the landlord I was describing before. We used that tactic and we marched on one of the offices of Transport Quebec in Longueuil. We shut down work for a bit. We read out statements from encampment residents and also demands. And so once that action was over, we then did a larger public demonstration, which happened on Monday. And that was a successful demonstration. It was a good turnout for definitely the time of year. It was very, very cold. We had one of the encampment residents cook food for people. There was some graffiti that was done during the demonstration of a few Transport Quebec locations. And overall, it helped to, I think, start to alert the media that an eviction was impending. And now we do have more information that an eviction is probably set for the middle of March or as soon as the snow melts.
Abigail, you've been at these encampment support actions, so maybe you can provide your perspective on that.
Sure. I mean, I just want to say, like, fuck the police. I cannot believe that we live in a society that allows people to sleep on the streets in the first place, but then we'll also weaponize this arm of the state to try to remove them from where they've built a home. It just makes me, like, it makes my blood boil. I'm really glad that we've started building some solidarity with the residents of the Ville Marie encampment, because I think it's really, really crucial that we have some kind of network that can push back against this form of violence.
Abigail and Stefan, I want to get into the more general housing struggle and housing situation on the island of Montreal. It's a topic that could probably take another hour, so I know that you really can't, we can't get into it as much as that we would like to, but you know, the situation has appreciably gotten a lot worse in the last 5 to 10 years. You've mentioned the term rent evictions, which is where people are evicted under the pretense of renovations, and then the rents are raised. Part of that is also denying basic services or other things to housing to sort of make people despondent and want to move, and then rents can be raised. There's the whole financialization of real estate as well, where the more nasty a landlord is, the better it is within capitalism. You know, there's tons of housing or potential housing that's left vacant. It's a really horrible situation. So talk about that more general situation that's happening in Montreal from your perspective as tenants, as organizers with the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union. Give our listeners a sense of what tenants are up against right now in Montreal. People use the term housing crisis. That has a limited meaning sometimes. It's just that there's less housing to go into, less housing that's available than people who are looking on July 1st. But I think the housing crisis is much deeper than that. And this idea that somehow Montreal was not dealing with the dynamics of, say, Toronto or Vancouver or other cities where there's expensive rents is now over. That reality is over. So talk about that. Maybe we'll start with Abigail.
Sure, yeah. I moved to Montreal in late 2019, which I think that the average price of rent for like any sized unit was still hovering around $800-ish. And I've just watched it skyrocket over the past 3 years, which has been pretty disturbing. Yeah, you touched on the problem of there are lots of vacant units, which is also something I think about a lot, because I think under capitalism, there's this tendency to attribute the housing crisis to like a problem of scarcity, because there's this idea that like, oh, the invisible hand of the free market or whatever is what's causing rents to rise. And it's like, no, your landlord is what's causing rents to rise. This is like a conscious decision that powerful actors in the system are playing. Like, I think it's just really important for people to remember that like there are people behind the housing crisis. It's not just like this vague idea of the free market. You know, we had a comrade send us a photo of a 5.5 that's going for like $3,500 a month the other day, which is crazy. I'm profoundly disturbed by the fact that landlords have been able to raise rent this much. But I think that the good thing is also that it's an opportunity to maybe mobilize our communities more. We've done a couple events educating people on how to refuse their rent increase because that process is extremely confusing. And I think it also is important for people to remember that like you have power. You can try to negotiate with landlords who are trying to screw you over, asking like $1,200 a month from each tenant in a two-bedroom apartment. That's like crazy. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling here. Stefan, do you want to jump in?
Oh, I don't think you're rambling at all. It's infuriating what you're describing. And anybody who's a tenant, I'm a tenant, I'm facing a reprise de logement, which is when a landlord says they're going to technically move in. It's scary. And, you know, everything, it's just horrible. And to me, there's a disjunction between how much anger there should be and rambling, as you put it, and upsetness, and what there is on the streets. Because without a sort of a mass movement, people are going to continue to be in a really shitty situation for something that is a basic right, and that's to have a place to live that's safe, warm, and affordable. Anyways, that's my rambling. I'll turn over to Stefan to address this topic.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it's I mean, I grew up in Montreal, and I also remember when rents weren't as high as they currently are. But now it seems that like conversations I'm having, not even about the union, the fact that rent is just way too expensive and eating up people's paychecks and demanding that people work more than they should is just something that seems to come up pretty organically. Even when talking with people who are pretty much strangers, it is a phenomenon that's sort of displacing people into sort of the peripheries of the metropolis. Evictions have, I think, doubled between 2021 and 2022. They've actually a bit more than doubled. They've increased by 150%, if I'm not mistaken, or something like that. And the biggest increases are in things like, I guess, what you're facing there, Jaggi, which is like a reprise de logement. Those, if I remember correctly, have increased by like something like over four times as much. As have things like just like a general eviction, because people are just getting too poor to afford their rent, and they're being court ordered to leave their apartments, to imaginably find some other place to live or live on the streets. It is, yeah, I mean, rents are just growing out of pace. I believe in 2010, average rents were something like $700. They've climbed up to, in the last statistic I saw was, I think, from 2020, in which average rents were around $900. But now, if you're signing on to a new lease, the average rent for that is something like $1,400, $1,500. So there have been massive increases in rents. And like I think Abby was talking about, this is like all within the dynamic of the capitalist housing market, in which landlords are incentivized to provide the worst conditions possible, the least services as possible, at the highest rents possible. We do have like alternative models that we look to. Like there's a very successful cooperative housing movement in Montreal, especially in the Milton Park neighborhood, where I do a lot of my organizing. And there's 1,500 people living in not profit housing and cooperative housing, in which housing is managed democratically by tenants without a landlord, and not managed with the profit motive. And it's extremely successful. Like people are still paying $400, $500 a month in rent, and people are not facing the same issues that tenants face of housing precarity and the fear of eventually losing their home, either because their building is sold or because the landlord decides that they want to move in like a new class of sort of like university students who can pay more in rent every month. So I guess that's sort of our perspective on it.
Yeah, and even if you're looking, there's credit checks. They want references. They want to know that you have a job, and all these things. Normal people will have something that that they won't be able to offer. They're like the new tenant in Montreal that these landlords want is some super tenant that's never had a problem with a credit check and is always employed and is making a lot of money. It's just absurd. So let's wrap up here. I just have one other topic area, and then I'll ask a final question, but Montreal and other cities in Quebec have housing committees. You mentioned early in the interview that you stress direct action casework and less sort of using what's at the Tribunal Administratif de Logement, which is formerly known as the Régie de Logement, just sort of the housing board. I often see like if we need a movement, there needs to be complementarity between the people who are sort of doing day-to-day work, providing people with their rights, and often accompanying people who are dealing with the TAL hearing, which is what housing committees do. And of course, the more direct action-oriented, autonomous organizing that you're doing. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about that, the relationship with housing committees and housing coalitions that already exist, some of which have been around a long time. They're consistently doing actions, whether in neighborhoods or on a provincial scale. Talk about that relationship. I guess one background for me is during the pandemic, before the CERB came in, there was serious talk about a rent strike. A lot of folks, I can speak for myself as well, were like, I'm not going to be able to make rent. I can't work. And when CERB came in, that took sort of some of the momentum off of that reality. But prior to that, there was significant talk about a rent strike, a website got set up, an organization, but there was a sort of a pushback by some housing committees, some individuals, not everyone, of course, about, you know, whether rent strikes are possible and using the TAO process to your benefit. So talk about what that relationship has been like, if it's been, if there's been any kind of relationship like that. I'll start with you, Stefan.
I think I maybe have the most polemical of union members position on housing committees. I do like a lot of the activists who work in the housing committees. I also think that they do, like, they are really in touch with, like, a lot of tenants, and they can bring people out. They like, from things I've seen, they've been able to bring out, like, hundreds of people and even sometimes thousands of people to demos. And so they have, like, a huge outreach. And that speaks to the fact that they have built up a lot of trust and relationships with tenants. That being said, I do think they do serve a very, in my opinion, stabilizing role in many respects. That I actually do find destructive to a possible tenants movement, perhaps in two major ways. I think they funnel a lot of what could be a mass revolutionary energy or a mass movement to directly target specific landlords. They funnel that into things like legislative and reformist demands. To the Quebec government for things like more social housing, or things like rent freezes. Unfortunately, like we've seen, the Quebec government has no interest in any of these things, and they recently actually just passed legislation to end Accès Logis, which provides social housing. And unfortunately, that's a lot of time and energy put into, like, mobilizing tenants to attend demonstrations, writing up policy proposals and policy reports. That people just won't be getting back, and that is going into, at the end of the day, what seems to be, like, a very impossible goal with the CAC government, and also an ultimately reformist demand, instead of spreading things such as just a general tendency towards accepting that landlords should not exist in any shape or form in our society, and organizing tenants for that reality. And also understanding that if there's going to be, like, a change in housing conditions within Montreal, it won't come through reform, but rather through, like, direct action, and hopefully a revolution, which tenants take back their homes. And then on the other hand, also I tend to think that, like, advising tenants to take their issues to court and to get together, if they get together with the neighbors, to aim it at getting what they have the right to be very short-sighted, in the sense of it makes tenants focus on what are their personal issues and not seeing their personal issues as political and collective issues, and also uses mechanisms of the state tribunals in order to get what they want, instead of relying on their own organizing efforts and teaching themselves useful skills that will serve them in order to get bigger gains. Of course, like, there's profound limitations to what we can get through the court system. It's not there to protect our interests. It's there to mediate some of the abuses of landlords. And it will never give us things like rent freezes. It'll never give us things like rent decreases. But organizing through direct action and doing rent strikes have and will. There have been some interesting, I'll just kind of finish here, like, there have been some interesting movements in history, including in, say, Barcelona in 1931, in which, like, 100,000 tenants went on rent strike and were building barricades in the streets to stop evictions, or in Harlem in 1963, black tenants in Harlem in New York, they launched a rent strike of 180 families, and they got a rent reduction to $1 a month briefly. And if we're ever going to get to a place like that, it really has to be through, it can't be through taking things to court, but rather through sort of very concerted syndicalist organizing.
Abigail, did you want to chime in on this topic?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, in my opinion, like the law isn't real. I took a philosophy of law class a few years ago, and that was the big conclusion I came to, because I just feel like you end up at the whim of some random judge who is going to decide the fate of your housing situation, which I just feel like is profoundly disempowering. Like, I think that the legal system, just the way it is structured, disenfranchises tenants as opposed to direct action, where you can build more power as a collective. I think it is possible for us to work with housing committees on like a short-term basis, and we have, like with our refuse your rent increase workshops. We did that in collaboration with the Comité Logement du Plateau Mont-Royal, which was successful. Also, like if a tenant ultimately decides they want to go to the TAL, we can put them in touch with a housing committee who is maybe better equipped to deal with that. But yeah, I would agree with Stefan. I think that our philosophies are just fundamentally incompatible, because it's like, are we trying to dismantle the current system and build a new one, or are we just trying to like kind of prop up this system that is already failing and does nothing to empower tenants?
Yeah, I'd add on to that. Like, that reminds me of just like so many situations where I've been having conversations with tenants and members of housing committees who like are more even more militant members, and their first reaction to an issue is always like when we're talking about their housing issues, it's like, oh, I'm gonna take it to the tribunal, and then we'll suggest something like a direct action, like, oh, maybe get a petition together or like hang banners from your balcony. And then tenants would be like, no, I know my rights. Like, I'm gonna go to the tribunal and I'm gonna get this solved directly. I don't need to take the risk of I don't want to take the legal risk of getting together with neighbors. I don't want to take the legal risk of possibly getting evicted for this. Like, that's not the smart thing to do. I know I have rights here and I'm gonna go to the tribunal to execute them. And so it creates a situation where people are actually just not doing essential community organizing to help their neighbors get the same things that they might get from housing tribunals. Not to mention the fact that like oftentimes we have very high expectations of what these things like tribunals can give us.
Abigail and Stefan from the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, you've been really generous with your time providing perspective on housing struggles and your organizing. So let's wrap this up, and each of you can maybe give our listeners a final word of maybe a bit of inspiration or something that tenants, when I say listeners, are listeners that are tenants, not the landlords, can do to fight back against these injustices. So maybe Abigail, you can start, and then we'll wrap up with Stefan.
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing I would say is, if you do not know your neighbors, like knock on their door, introduce yourself, try to become friends, maybe start a group chat in your building. Even if your conditions are not like totally awful, it's just good to know your neighbors. It's good to have a kind of mutual aid network. I mean, I'm not really sure what to say other than that. I think it's just important for people to know that we are in this struggle together. So if you can help your neighbors, or even people in different buildings on your block, just start talking. That's the first step.
And Stefan.
Yeah, I totally agree with Abby there. Like, talking to neighbors, talking to them about issues in the buildings, getting their contact info, starting a group chat, trying to get a first meeting going. I think a lot of people think that their housing issues are personal issues, which makes sense. I mean, like, we tend to think most of our issues are personal and not political, but these things that personally affect us, this like these spats we're having with our landlords that we think are private. These are actually just a part of a collective issue, which we have been describing throughout this discussion, which is one of a landlord class which charges rent to the working class for something that we should fundamentally have without any without having to pay anybody interest in profit. Where was I going here? I mean, I think once we realize that these personal issues are actually part of a collective struggle, I think that will motivate us to get like together with neighbors, to start being more active around our housing issues and seeing them like we see other issues in our society, like climate change, and using the same tactics that we believe should be used to respond to the climate crisis, but to things like the housing crisis. I think for me, what really motivates me is this idea that one day I can live in a society in which like I do not have to work so hard in order to afford rent. I think that's one of the reasons people work so hard. It's just like in order to afford things that are really fundamentally that we should just get for free, that things that should be guaranteed by the fact that we are human beings. I think like one thing that I would say to people who are thinking about the housing crisis and housing organizing is like imagine a world in which we do not have to pay landlords for the right to have a house. I think that is like a beautiful vision. I also think one thing to also imagine is imagine like a massive tenant movement. Like imagine that just like in the labor movement, like hundreds of thousands of people in Quebec were in a tenant union and capable of doing things like massive rent strikes. That could mean so much, not just for the housing crisis, but it could also mean things like solidarity actions with other political groups, such as the labor movements has done for a long time, solidarity actions against Israeli apartheid, or solidarity actions with the environmental movement, like going on strike in order to prevent logging. I think like the same solidarity could be illustrated within the tenant movement. And so there's a huge interest among all people to try to bolster that kind of organizing.
Well, in the spirit of talking to your neighbors, I'm hoping a lot of tenants on the island of Montreal, or anywhere really, where people need to organize for justice on the housing issue, hear this and are inspired. So Abigail and Stéphane, thank you so much. From the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, Syndicat des Locataires Autonomes de Montréal, or SLAM, thank you so much for speaking with us on No Borders Media and CKUT's Off the Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jaggy, for having us.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in Ganiagaha and Muniang in Anishinaabe, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, live in studio on Thursday, March 2nd, 2023. We're kicking off a new month. It's also International Women's Month and Women's History Month, so a very happy that to you. It is currently +1 in Montreal. We have light snow falling. It's going to wrap up soon, and they just issued a special weather statement for Saturday. Lots of snow ahead. We got tons on Tuesday, we got tons today, not as much of course, and now they're saying we could get anywhere between 10 to 15 on Saturday. So I hope you love skiing and tobogganing, because that's really how you got to appreciate this kind of weather, I think. In any case, what can you expect on tonight's show? My guests include puppets and politicians, a farcical exploration of power in The King Stinks. That is a show from Surreal Surreal Theatre, Castellier, and Infinite Theatre Montreal. I will speak with Zach Fraser, the artistic director at Infinite Theatre, ahead of opening night. And speaking of Castellier, the puppetry festival for all ages is back in full force with productions from around the world. France, Czechia, Taiwan, Belgium, and some, of course, from right here in Montreal and in Quebec. Shows for kids and the adults